Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, Spectator Life's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
Today we are delighted to be joined by Max Pemberton, a doctor, journalist and writer who specialises in mental health. He's the author of three books based on his own experience working as a doctor, a CBT book about giving up smoking, and most recently, The Marvellous Adventures of Being Human, Your Amazing Body and How to Live in It, an illustrated children's book that looks at how best to live in your own body. Max, welcome to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Max, you grew up in West London in the 1980s. What was food like when you were younger?
Quite basic, but quite nice. I still eat quite a lot of the same types of food. Like every Saturday and every Sunday, I still have waffles. You know, like McCain waffles, like potato waffles. I really love them. They're so nice. My family were very busy. My dad was a milkman. And my mum got a job actually in Marks and Spencer's, like when I was probably about four or five, just on a Saturday doing like shelf stacking. So she would always kind of get the cheap stuff right at the very end. You know, the kind of reducing it down and down and down. And then sort of at the very, very end, as they sort of closed, anything that was left, the staff could sort of take massively discounted. So it was relatively kind of humble sort of environment, but actually suddenly we'd have all this really exciting, you know, kind of prawn rings and kind of really exciting foods. So on a Saturday evening was always kind of like this feast, because there'd be all sorts of different foods like guacamole and stuff that I'd never come across, and it was lots of kind of stimulation. So yeah, but then aside from that, it was basically fish fingers, waffles seemed to feature really heavily in my childhood, I've got to say, and sort of vegetables as well. My mum was always very, very, before it was like cool, she was very kind of concerned about sort of eating, trying to buy organic food if you could, buy locally sourced food. But my mum in particular, both my parents were sort of quite political activists. My mum was involved a lot in the miners' strikes. So there was a kind of whole sense of, you know, kind of Friends of the Earth. They were active members of Friends of the Earth and that sort of stuff like in the 80s. So there was like a real sense of like, you know, you have to be careful what you buy. It's a kind of political statement. So my mum was always very critical of people that would buy sort of very cheap meat, for example. So we would only have meat really sort of maybe once or twice a week, but she'd try and buy sort of good quality, locally sourced meat.
And was she a good cook?
No, dreadful. She'd actually say that. She would, I mean, 100% say that. I mean, she was always given, I mean, bless her, she tried. Like, stuff like banana ice cream, and she did the recipe, went wrong. And we had like literally litres of it. I mean, leaves and leaves and leaves. And I remember my whole childhood, it seemed to be just eating this banana ice cream, which went on, I mean, literally years. And there were like tubs of it, and you'd like open everything, and there'd just be banana ice cream everywhere. And you'd go around my grand's house or my auntie's house, and they'd be like, please, Julia, that's my mum, please, Julia, just get rid of this bloody banana ice cream. And you'd open their freezer, and they'd be like chest freezers full of banana ice cream everywhere. And actually, what we didn't realise is after about a week, just like a banana, it goes brown. So actually, we had like years of eating this brown, disgusting banana ice cream. But, you know, because we made it, we had to persevere.
And because your father was a milkman, did you have lots of milk as well? Was that able to
We must have done. I don't particularly remember us drinking a lot of milk, but I mean, we definitely must have done. I do remember when they introduced, they probably still do it now, they introduced orange, like a pint of orange, and it was in a milk thing. And to
it was
me,
a different coloured top.
Yeah, orange.
Yeah. They got the marketing really well, though, didn't they?
And to me, though, this is like extraordinary, because I was like, hang on a minute, it's orange, but it's in milk bottles. This doesn't make sense. And so that was like my big thing. Like, throughout my whole childhood, I must have been probably about five or six when this sort of was introduced. And it was when milkmen, so they were trying to sort of slightly diversify a bit more. So they kind of, you know, were doing much more bread and sort of like, you know, vegetables and stuff like this. And so they also started doing this orange. And so that was my thing, is that every single day I would have a pint of orange, which I'm sure looking back can't be very good for you. But that would be like my thing, is that, you know, kind of at breakfast and then sort of later on in the day, I sort of drink my pint of orange. So I do remember a lot of orange, more than milk, but I'm sure we did have milk.
And were you a good eater as a child, or were you fussy or picky?
So I became, my parents are horrified. I mean, genuinely horrified. When I was about eight, I decided to become vegetarian. And I remember this row. I mean, God. And my family, again, you know, they worked really, really hard. And you know, they were careful about what food they gave us. A lot of it was kind of, you know, smiley face potato things. But, you know, it wasn't, we never had like junks. We weren't allowed crisps and things like that. But it was a lot of pressure, time pressure within our family. And the idea that my mum would suddenly, or my dad would suddenly start cooking two meals, never going to happen. So they basically said, well, look, if you don't want to eat meat, then fine, we'll just cook and you can just eat everything else, but just not the meat. They're never, the idea of doing something separate, that was never going to happen. So I went for a little while where, you know, everyone was having roast chicken and I was just having the vegetables and the mashed potato and thought, this is a bit bleak. So then I discovered Linda McCartney frozen food. So once we got rid of, shipped some of the banana ice cream out of the freezer,
make some room.
I could then put frozen. So I then took responsibility for then kind of making the things like sausages. So I ate a lot of corn sausages. I've had them, or like Linda McCartney sausages. I'm surprised they didn't turn into one as a kid, because I must have eaten literally millions of these things. So I had that, and actually in those days it was quite hard actually to even get hold of it. So there was a health food shop not far from where we lived, and I'd sort of probably about a mile and a half, and I'd have to often kind of go to these big sort of journeys to sort of get this vegetable, textured soy protein, TSP, I think they called it. So you'd go and like find this stuff, and some of it you had to get dried, and then you'd have to sort of like swell it, and it'd grow like some sort of fungus or something. And you'd like sort of swell it all up and then use it. But it was actually, in that sense, it was quite good, because it meant that I was quite sort of relatively independent. My family were quite sort of just relaxed about everything, and everything was sort of, you know, it's a little bit chaotic. And so it sort of fitted in quite well. It was just like, oh, he's off to kind of go and grill his sausages.
did you stay a vegetarian?
I did for a really long time, actually, until I tried being a vegan. Just really, I think, just to annoy everybody. And let's admit it, vegans are quite annoying. So I became vegan for about a year when I was about 14 or 15. It was actually because my mum bought me this book about sort of animal rights and stuff. And it was never for sort of fanciful reasons of kind of liking bunnies or sheep or anything. It was just from the kind of process, from a much more kind of environmental perspective of kind of, you know, the environmental costs of making meat. And my mum got me this book, which again, sort of like 20, 30 years ago, it wasn't a widely known about kind of idea. And so I read this book, and it was saying, I remember it had this phrase about the bloody egg and dairy industry or something, and me thinking, but I don't understand, they don't die, I don't understand that. And then of course me twigging and thinking, oh, of course, but it's part of a whole bigger process. So I thought, right, okay, well, I'm going to be logical and follow through, and that means I just will kind of cut out eggs and cheese and everything else. And then after a year I just thought, god, screw this, it's so boring. and you also, it's just kind of coincided at the time, and all your friends are going out, and I remember there's this Italian restaurant called Francesco's, and everybody wanted to go to Francesco's, and you'd kind of sit there and go, you know, can I not have the cheese, and I don't want this. And this like old Italian papa was standing there going, what is this? It's crazy. And so in the end you just thought, screw it, okay, I'll just start. So I went back, but I still didn't eat meat really. And then I started going to the gym much more when I was in my sort of late 20s, 30s. And just suddenly one day I was at the King's Cross, just standing, but literally just about to get on the tube, and I had this genuinely overwhelming urge to eat chicken. And I mean, I hadn't eaten chicken by that point for like 20 plus years.
That's so weird.
And I mean, it was really like a, you know, zombie kind of, just like, I need flesh.
Did you go?
So I went out of the tube station, went into St Pancras train station, into Marks and Spencer's, bought a tray of the pre-cooked chicken, stood on outside the Eurostat, opened it and ate it, and then I phoned my mum going, I've just eaten roast chicken. And she was like, oh, you absolute weirdo. She's very unsympathetic. And you know, since then I've sort of now I eat chicken. I'm not mad keen. I have tried red meat, but I'm not particularly that mad keen on it. So I tend to just eat chicken. I do also eat fish now. I kind of feel, I think because I was vegetarian from such a young age, this whole thing, so I've never eaten, like I've never had steak, for example, just because I was too young really to sort of have it. And then when I've tried it since, I'm just not that keen on it. So I'm much more relaxed with that. I think it was probably because I started going to the gym, putting on a bit more muscle, and my body just needed that kind of, you know, additional protein. Since then, I've sort of relaxed much more my sort of diet. And I just thought, well, actually, why would I bother sticking to a label? If I want, I should be able to, you know, eat chicken if I want. And who cares if there's not a special label for that? So, yeah, so I tend not to eat red meat, but I'd eat sort of fish, shellfish and chicken. I've tried duck recently. That was okay. It was all right.
The most underwhelming review of duck ever. It was okay.
And what about, I mean, should we infer from the fact you were hanging out in Francesca's that school food wasn't that good? Or do you have happy memories of school food?
Well, actually, so I went to quite an unusual school. So it was run by nuns. It was a convent run by nuns. And they'd only just started allowing boys in when I went. And I think they kind of weren't prepared for boys, what that was like. So they kind of felt quite overwhelmed constantly. Kind of, you turn around corners, it'd just be nuns kind of quite alarmed all the time, just like standing there with their rosaries.
Regretting their decisions.
Yeah, okay, this was a mistake. But what was interesting and what I really liked about this school, it was in quite a grotty, rough area. But actually, and because it was selective, but it was you know, state school, but predominantly drawing from the kind of Catholic community. And so you got quite a mix of people. You've got some really people from really affluent backgrounds, but equally some people from really impoverished backgrounds. And so the nuns' kind of idea was, we're going to be this kind of oasis, and we are going to kind of nourish not only your brain, but also your body. So they were very strict. So we weren't allowed to eat chips. We couldn't have any fried food. They wouldn't allow us to have things like crisps. So all that kind of stuff. So actually, even my mum, from when I was much, much younger, had been sort of, you know, instilling this in me and sort of trying to get me to, you know, not have junk food, as she would call it. Then when I went to school, to secondary school, this was, you know, further. So I sort of perpetuated this idea. So actually, you had to have vegetables, you had to have a piece of fruit at break time. So they were quite prescriptive, which actually is really good, because I think, I mean, certainly now I work with lots of younger people who've got problems with food, and you realise that, you know, kind of kids will just get used to just eating a plate of chips every day, and that is their lunch. Mm-hmm. And actually, the nun's idea was, you know, if we're going to teach you stuff, we need you to be, you know, kind of nourished not only intellectually but also physically, in order that you can make the most of your schooling experience, which again was sort of really forward thinking.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And there's a real kind of idea around it, everything being balanced. So it's okay to have a treat, but it's going to be balanced, which again is something I spend my whole life talking to youngsters about. Going, you know, it's not good food or bad food, it's about kind of balance. Yeah. And then, you know, there was a group of kind of nuns, admittedly with their backs against the wall going, what's happening? But, you know, they were already kind of on the forefront of this, so yeah.
And when you left school and went to university, you know, most of us at that point become responsible for our own food in a way that we weren't previously. We know about the TSP Linda McCartney sausages. How did you cope when suddenly everything you were eating was down to you?
I remember, actually, so I went to medical school in London, and I lived in Bloomsbury at the time, and I remember really consciously there was a Safeway in Bloomsbury in the Brunswick Centre, now turned into a Waitrose.
It's a Waitrose, I know what you mean.
It's gentrified, but at the time it was a Safeway. Yes. And I remember this time, it was probably about week two or week three, walking around and kind of doing the, like, oh, could I get vegetables, and thinking, no, I don't. And it was this revelation of me thinking, I can do whatever I want. And I remember buying loads and loads and loads, like, properly, like a whole stack of party rings, because I thought, you know, well, why only have one packet of party rings when you really love them?
Who's going to stop me having 20?
Exactly. And then I do remember about 2 days later going, oh, this is why people don't just eat party rings. Now I get it. And it's been really quite a kind of key moment in my life, kind of with regard to food, thinking, oh, do you know what? Yes, party rings are nice, but on your fourth packet, you feel sick and you never want party rings again. And so, yeah, so then I kind of realised. So I would say from then on, I took fairly responsible, actually. Yeah, I've kind of always quite liked... I'm not that sort of bothered about food particularly. I know some people sort of really love cooking, and they kind of, you know, it's a real kind of fetish for them about the kind of process of either making it or trying to explore stuff and try different ingredient things. And to me, it's just never been interesting. It's always just functional. And food is just something that you have to kind of get through. Like a meal is, you get through it in order to do something else that's more exciting. But, you know, even if I go out with friends, I'm like, oh, come on, let's just get the food done. And then we can kind of chat and drink and so on and so on. The actual food side of things, I could take it or leave it. I've got a really unsophisticated palate, I think it is fair to say. So I'm not mad keen on anything kind of spicy or particularly flavoured. Like, one of my favourite foods is mashed potato, which and jacket potato. If ever I was kind of, you know, on, you know, my last meal, if I've kind of committed some horrendous crime and I'm actually executed, my last meal would probably be jacket potato with cheese. So, my joy. I mean, what is that? Why would you bother with spices?
How'd you beat that?
Exactly. So it's kind of relatively unsophisticated, and probably if I'd had maybe a more sophisticated upbringing with food, maybe I would have learnt to kind of appreciate it more. Whereas for me, I'm just like, it's just energy, get it in your face, you know, swallow, move on.
And how, when you started doing, like, punishing shifts as a junior doctor, how does that work? If you don't have a huge amount of interest in food, but you have to refuel in order to keep going, how did you manage your time? What were you eating?
That is a good question.
Was it party rings?
Yes. So when I was a junior doctor, it was just the time before, they've changed it a lot now. They've put lots of rules and regulations around kind of the amount of hours. It's still not perfect at all, but kind of the amount of hours you could work in a row. When I was a junior doctor, that they didn't have that in there. We used to do shifts for 24 hours, so you would literally just be in hospital. You'd start at midday and you would go all the way through the daytime, all the way through the nighttime, and in midday you would leave. And sometimes actually you couldn't leave because there was still stuff going on. So it would be like the evening and you'd have kind of, you know, been 30 hours and you hadn't slept and you obviously didn't eat, properly at all. The biggest problem for us was actually, I found, was drinking. And I remember once, a friend actually I saw at the weekend, I remember us both being in A&E, and we'd been there for kind of like 15 hours or something and just hadn't stopped. And we said, do you know, God, I've not had a drink. And it's like yesterday. And us realising that actually yesterday was past, and it was actually probably the day before yesterday. And we did bloods on each other. We just took bloods and sent them off to the lab, and we were both in acute renal failure because we hadn't been drinking. And actually, that was a real kind of watershed moment. I remember nurses, when we were talking about it with the nurses, they were like, this is what's happened. You have to prioritise drinking. It's really important. So actually, from then on, I always made sure I was carrying water with me, or I'd had a drink, or I'd stop and make myself have tea or something like that to try and make sure I was, you know, had enough fluid on board. But certainly the food thing, I mean, I've always said to junior doctors, make sure, get loads of stuff in the freezer.
If you are a junior doctor, I mean, do you bring your food with you? I mean, if you're working a really long shift, do you bring your lunch with you?
The problem is, in theory, yes, you would do that. And I always used to do that. And I used to take like a big bag with me, kind of full of food and stuff like that. And I'd often stop off. So later on when I was doing shifts, you'd do like 12-hour shifts and you'd be working a night shift, for example. And I would stop off at the supermarket beforehand, just before I got to work, kind of stock up on lots of nice food. The thing you have to be careful about, you find yourself binging on just basically high sugar, calorie dense stuff.
Energy.
Because you're delaying eating until you're absolutely starving, and then you need a kind of sugar rush. So you have to be quite careful of that, of not sort of falling into that habit. But I would the difficulty you have with bringing your own stuff, though, is often there's not a fridge to put stuff in. So actually, if you're having a sandwich and it's like 12 hours later, it can also not always be that lovely.
It's not like it's been sitting for 2 hours in an office.
That's the problem. Certainly when you're doing day shifts, you can, I'll often go to the canteen. Actually, their food's often quite nice. People sort of complain about hospital food, but it's usually okay. So I'd often do that. The night times are difficult, is often the canteens are closed, and you have to be, I mean, this is the kind of thing that all junior doctors do. They realise actually you can only get so much sustenance from a vending machine, and you have to sort of be kind of mindful of that, because you do end up really eating for a year or a couple of years just basically junk if you're not careful.
And when you were 23, when you were working as a junior doctor, you wrote to Charles Moore and got this column in The Telegraph.
Bless Charles Moore. Honestly, I remain eternally grateful to him. He's like changed my whole life. It's amazing.
Am I right in thinking that people would... You wrote about the sort of struggle of eating properly as a junior doctor, and Telegraph readers...
What did they send you? You've done so much research. I'm so impressed. God, I didn't even know what day of the week it was today. You've like done all this research. That's right. Yes, there was. Oh, it was so sweet. These people. And you know, there was one particular woman called Jill who I'm still in touch with, and she's still. I mean, bless her. She's still. Every time I see her, makes me cakes, coconut ice. I wrote once about coconut ice and how much I loved it, and I couldn't get hold of it, and you're craving for it. And oh my God, I just got inundated with coconut ice. I was like, it was just so much of it.
I hope
so
Jill's listening.
All these people, it was so lovely. All these people buying me coconut ice. And she made me coconut ice and like herself put it in all these tubs, sent it off to us. And she always makes me cakes to try and sort of feed me up and stuff. Now I don't need it so much, but it's really lovely. So yeah, that was very, very sweet. I think because I was writing it, it was, you know, just my sort of diary of my life. And sometimes it was quite raw. Sometimes it was kind of quite fun and, you know, lighthearted. But other times it was quite raw and quite sad. And, you know, it's, and I was trying to be as honest as I possibly could from my experiences. And, you know, sometimes you would be sitting there and you'd be holding an old lady's hand and she'd be dying, and you'd be sitting there thinking, I'm so hungry. All I need to do is eat. And you'd have these conflicts, and it was awful. And you'd be kind of, you know, and also I was like 23. I was really young when I graduated, and you'd be sort of sitting there thinking, this should not be right. I should be like getting drunk and like falling out of a club. And instead I'm sitting here like, you know, ravenous and kind of hands are shaking and having to tell someone they've got a brain tumour or whatever. You know, so all these massive kind of emotional things. And also you become very acutely aware of when you're really hungry, how that impacts on your ability to think. And I remember various kind of mistakes that I made, realizing this is because I've not eaten properly. And again, sort of those things only happen a couple of times, and you think, actually, I need to learn from this, and I need to make sure
this is too important.
That really, looking back, of course, this is a stupid mistake, but what was I thinking? Well, actually, I wasn't thinking, because I was just so hungry, and I've not eaten, I've not drunk. And actually, it would have been much better if I carve out time to ensure that it's actually safer for my patients, rather than me rushing around. It actually would be safer if I said, actually, do you know what, I can't do this just yet, give me 15 minutes, I need to eat. And so after that, I used to set an alarm on my phone to make sure that I was eating regularly. So it became quite important. But yeah, it was very sweet. So Telegraph readers really sort of took me to their heart. And was sort of, sorry.
And some, is it right that someone came around and cooked at your flat?
Yes, that's right as well.
That's so kind.
I know, so sweet. Honestly, people are so lovely. And I remember lots and lots of times patients going, because it would tend to be elderly ladies, so I worked in geriatrics, and they'd be going, you look like you've lost weight. And I'd be like, no, I'm fine. Have you eaten? Have a York fruit. I don't really want York. Have a York fruit. I go and like sort of haranguing my
bosses. Does anyone ever want a York fruit, no matter how hungry they are?
And sort of ever so sweet. I think it is because, you know, junior doctors, looking back, you know, when you're 23, 24, you are really young.
You're a baby. Yeah.
And you are there, and I'm sure you do look a bit startled all the time. And you're part of a much bigger machine of actually people that do know what they're doing and they're older and they're kind of professionals. And actually, you are at the bottom. And I think if you're, as a patient, you're kind of aware of that. And I think lots of people used to sort of maybe mother me or kind of sit there and think, you know, and all my kind of colleagues at my sort of level, they sort of mother you a bit, or, you know, sort of be a bit sort of like grandparents and be sort of like a bit worried. So even though you were there to try and help them, I think they kind of sat there and thought, actually,
we need, you know, to help him.
Go and have a sandwich.
Go and give him a
go now. They often do that. Yeah, it's kind of, it was very sweet, actually.
And you ended up with a specialism in eating disorders.
Yeah.
Was that a deliberate move, or was it organic career-wise? How did you end up there?
Well, that's interesting, actually. There's probably two things. The kind of prosaic, simple thing was that somebody who's actually an incredibly, incredibly well-known eating disorder specialist called Eric Sabine, he's very sort of famous with eating disorders. I just sort of came across him. I'd taken some time off to write. One of my bosses was one of his friends, a contemporary of his, who'd mentioned that I was kind of taking some time off to write. And he had a project and said, look, well, why are you taking 6 months off? Why don't you come and do some work with me? And I just thought, you just don't get the opportunity, really, to work with this man. And he's, you know, he was nearing retiring. And I just thought, this is what, you know, one of the kind of great institutions of kind of medicine. And I was like, you know, I want to kind of go and work with him for a bit. So I took the opportunity. And that was how it kind of then, I then sort of went into that specialty. I'd already been interested in it. I'd already done some work in it. Because when I was a junior doctor, I'd been a doctor for probably about 6 months, which in medical world is probably the worst, most dangerous time. Everyone worries about when people first hit the ward. But everybody else is looking out for you and they're double checking everything you're doing. But also, you know nothing.
You're terrified.
Yeah. You're terrified, and rightly so, because you're complete dumb and you don't know what's going on. And you don't even know, you know, you can't even find the toilets. I mean, it's just like chaos. So, and you know that, the difficulty is that when you're about 6 months in, you kind of have got this kind of slight, you're a bit cocky. You kind of think you know much more than you. And I remember this lecture at medical school saying, and the lecture was the importance of knowing about not knowing. And actually, that is what you realise, that's the most important thing about medicine. It's not what you know, it's what you don't know, and making sure you know what you don't know. And the problem is, 6 months in, people tend to forget that. So it's about 6 months in, and this young woman came in, she was about 17 or 18, and she came in, she was brought in by her parents. And her parents were really worried. She had chest pain, and they were saying, we think she's having a heart attack. And I was sort of there, like not knowing anything about anything, and was reassuring and said, oh, don't be, she's 18. And they were kind of quite well to do. And so I said, oh, God, you're neurotic middle class. And I said, you know, no, of course she's not. And I sort of reassured them, put her on a trolley, hooked her up for an ECG. The parents were in the waiting room. She was having a heart attack and she died. She died about 10 minutes later. And I hadn't done anything wrong. You know, she was admitted, she was there, she was on a cardiac monitor. So all of that was done right. But the consultant, the consultant was there, and I kind of went up to him and said, you know, oh my God, I've just been reassuring the parents. And he said, well, why did you do that? And I said, well, because she's 18. She's not going to have a heart attack. And he said, well, obviously you were wrong, because she's dead from a heart attack. And did you know that she had anorexia? And I said, well, no, but why would that give her a heart attack? And he said, you need to go and you need to read about eating disorders if you don't know this. And your punishment, as it were, you need to remember this for the rest of your life. And so you have to go and tell the parents. So I had to go back into the waiting room. I had to get the parents out, take them into the relative's room and sit and say, actually, look, I'm really sorry. I reassured you, but actually she was having a heart attack and she has now died. And it had such a, quite rightly, I mean, it's quite horrible of the professor to do this, but actually, do you know what? It changed the rest of my career.
Yeah.
Because I sat there and I remember walking back, and as I walked back home to my digs at the time, thinking, I have never done a day, I did not do a day's education at medical school on eating disorders. Really? Not a thing. We never were taught a single thing about it. And yet here is a young woman who has died because of it. I could tell you every obscure type of cancer, every weirdy beardy kind of like virus or infectious disease I'm never ever going to see. And yet this one thing that kills 1 in 5 people with an eating disorder will die from an eating disorder. So it kills 1 in 5 people with it. I've never heard of it. I don't know anything about it. So I went back and I studied and studied and studied, but really because of this woman dying and the kind of experience. And, you know, I mean, it was a really kind of profound, horrible encounter. And of course, from a purely personal, you know, selfish point of view, me thinking, God, this is so humiliating. You know, I've got to kind of admit, and it sounds awful, but that is the feeling you have of thinking, God, I've just been reassuring these people and they're going. And they kept on saying, but you said it was going to be okay. You said it was going to be okay. And me thinking, yeah, well, this is because I basically don't know anything. So after that, I did do work in eating disorders, but I didn't get this opportunity. And now I now work in a kind of, you know, big eating disorder unit. Mm. Really thanks for working with Eric, who then kind of took me under his wing a bit and got me in. But lots of people within medicine have got kind of slightly, it's often a patient or a couple of patients you've encountered at the very beginning, and then you then happen to get an opportunity later on, and then that will sort of set them off on a course of their whole career.
And the fact that you weren't taught about it at university, I mean, has the medical profession changed how it views eating disorders over the past 20 years?
I think it has, because I think it's had to. I still am quite shocked and surprised by the people who, I mean, even just today I saw a patient who had this, where they're kind of going to the doctor repeatedly saying, you know, I think I've got a problem, and the doctor saying, we don't look like you've got an eating disorder to me, and sort of sending them away. People, you know, have kind of dismissed, there's this idea that having an eating disorder, you basically have to be really, really skinny, you have to be a girl, you're probably going to be, you know, a teenager, and you're a bit sort of silly and giddy. That's the kind of, you know, typical idea.
It's a hysterical thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's this massive, massive amounts of stigma. And what's interesting as well is, even when patients get a diagnosis and they're within our service, we, particularly our service, will ask the GP to help us monitor the physical health side of things. And that's all to do with like, the commissioning, the way the NHS runs it. And I will write back to GPs and they will say, you know, I'll say, can you do bloods every fortnight, please? And this is this. And they'll say, no, I'm not doing bloods that often. And you say, wow, okay, well, it's the national guidelines, what we're recommending. And what I find it interesting is, when we talk about stigma around mental health, to me, this is really, really what stigma feels and looks like. You know, there's a lot of kind of stuff on Twitter about people getting up in arms about various things. But actually, to me, this is really what stigma is like, because you have the same, the average outcomes for brain tumours. You have a 1 in 5 chance of, just it's grossly kind of on average, 1 in 5 chance of dying from a brain tumour if you're diagnosed with a brain tumour. It is the same if you're diagnosed with anorexia. Now, imagine if I was a brain tumour specialist and I was writing to a doctor and say, hey, I'd like you to do bloods every 2 weeks. There is not a GP in this land that would say no. I mean, everybody, they'd be falling over. They say, you sure you don't want me to do it more often? And yet, the same outcome, so the same risk, so we can't say it's about risk, you get all this pushback. So the only thing that is different is how people perceive the illness. Now, to me, that's the stigma that we experience in mental illness. The fact that there are doctors, I have to say, there are lots and lots of brilliant GPs who aren't and are incredibly supportive, but it's just interesting that, dare I say, some of the old ones, not always, but some of the older ones, I think just don't understand. They haven't had those experiences, and they just sit there thinking, well, can't you just make them eat? Like, what's the problem? And they just don't understand. So I certainly think things are getting better, and I think they've had to get better because we've got increasing rates, and whether or not that's because they're genuinely increasing or because we've got better understanding and awareness amongst the general public is a sort of maybe slightly different question. But certainly referral rates are much, much, much higher now. They're sort of escalating. So people have had to get a bit more aware of what's going on.
I mean, obviously on this podcast we always talk a lot about food, but how do you go about talking about food with your patients? It must be quite a difficult topic.
It's
at times.
Really hard. It is very, and it can be really distressing for patients. You know, it's like all of these things, there's so much variation. So some patients will really love talking about food, actually, and they're very preoccupied around food, but they don't like eating it, but they'll happily talk about it, and they'll often come and they'll talk to you about recipes, and it's a real preoccupation. You typically, because they're so starved, actually, it's hard when you're denying food and you're so starving, there comes a point where it just becomes the one preoccupation in your mind. So often they will quite happily talk about it. There are other patients where they find it incredibly distressing. So then you have to talk about it in different ways, and kind of often, I always find, just in general in medicine, just being really honest with people and kind of quite open and saying, okay, so what's difficult for you? And, you know, how can we talk about this? Like, what can we do that's going to make it easier, given that we're going to have to talk about food in some way. So lots of patients find it quite helpful to think about it, not in terms of food, but in terms of kind of energy and kind of nourishment, and to try and turn it away from this idea of kind of there being good food or bad food or healthy food or unhealthy food, and just kind of strip it back into being, actually, do you know what, your body is very malnourished and it urgently needs, in order to repair itself, it needs nutrients. And so, and to kind of frame the conversation much more in that sort of way, people find it sometimes easier to deal with.
And that good food and bad food, the sort of virtue narrative, is something you've written about before in terms of the problems that clean eating have caused for eating disorders and disordered eating.
Yeah, drive through bananas.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Literally every, I would say pretty much every patient at the moment that I see will talk about clean eating. Pretty much everybody. The only variations I get are people that actually probably don't have an eating disorder and they're maybe slightly older and they've got other things that have resulted in their weight loss and I'm just giving a second opinion for it. Everybody with an actual eating disorder, it's like the narrative of our time. And it's interesting how these sorts of things come and go and sort of change and shift. For example, like some of my colleagues who've maybe been doing this even longer than me, one of my colleagues has been doing it for about kind of 30, 35 years in the same unit. And she will talk about how in the sort of like 80s, 90s kind of thing, there was a whole yoga stuff that everybody would be really, really, really into, like keep fit. Mm. And that was the kind of narrative. So it's all that kind of, you know, kind of pumping, sort of jumping around with little, you know, sweatbands on and stuff like that. And she's like, you know, so it was a much more kind of like exercise based kind of image. I think now, for various reasons, probably things like Instagram and the kind of fetishization of food and the way that kind of is on social media, it's now much more, there is still some of the kind of yoga retreaty kind of stuff, but it's much more about this kind of good food. It's got to be clean, it's got to be like low carb, etc., etc. And it's, I mean, lots of people have spoken about it. I'm not the only one about it. I think even Nigella Lawson has kind of come out talking about it. And it's a narrative I'm constantly pushing against. I mean, constantly. I spend hours of my life. I want to get some of these things tattooed on my forehead because I just need to spend my life talking about them. There's no such thing as good food and bad food. And actually, you know, even today I had somebody who actually we've had to admit she's so critically unwell. She's imminently going to die. And I was sitting there talking to her about how we would try and structure her meals. And I was talking to her, and this is an 18-year-old woman, and I was talking to her about, you know, we need to try and have regular eating to try and stabilise the blood glucose levels and this kind of stuff. And I said, you know, and you can have a snack. And she was saying, well, what would a snack be? And I was saying, well, you could have like a biscuit and you could have a hot chocolate. And she was horrified. And she was saying, yeah, but you can't, that's really unhealthy. And I was saying, yes, but you're about to die. Currently, your body is so malnourished and starved. It's eating itself. Like, trust me, a salad is currently unhealthy for you. Like, it's interesting. It's like this narrative is so ingrained. And it's not her fault. It's because she's being bombarded by these stories around, you know, healthy has got to be low carbohydrate. It's got to be, you know, kind of...
No refined sugars.
Exactly, yeah. You know, avoid, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And it's just constant. And it is hard. And I think doctors haven't always helped the situation because we sort of sit there going, like, we need to eat more vegetables. We need to do this. And then it's really hard. And then we go, we're eating too many vegetables. It's like, it's a really hard, complicated story. Yeah. And, you know, like exercise, well, don't exercise too much, I'm going to say. It's, you know, and it's that nuance that people often struggle. And that I would say we need to be careful about thinking that it causes an eating disorder. I think what it does, it creates a way of masking an eating disorder for a lot of people. And I think it puts in people's minds, I think it probably for a group of people, if they didn't develop an eating disorder, they would have had something else. They would have found another unhelpful, like maladaptive coping strategy. Because at the moment we're as a society quite preoccupied around body shape and food and so on, that becomes the thing on which the peg on which to hang these kind of other bigger emotional difficulties. But certainly things like social media, Instagram in particular, really does not help.
And would you speak to your client, your patients rather, about social media? Would you say that this is a risk?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And also the thing that we've experienced within our service is we have some people who have social media following, I mean, substantial, like massive, massive, massive groups of people. And they have an eating disorder. And they are posting, saying, you know, well, I've just eaten this like lovely quinoa and grapefruit salad and stuff. And actually, I know because I've sat there with them. They then are eating three Sara Lee chocolate gâteaux and then puking up again. And they don't put that on Instagram. And actually, it's really hard from an ethical point of view of like, you then have this, I mean, quite literally sometimes within a week, you have patients coming in who you know are following these other patients. And you think this is an absolute minefield because a lot of these people who are on social media will have an eating disorder. And they may either diagnose or not diagnose, but there's no way of you knowing it. And yet you're kind of given this narrative like, well, this is what I'm eating. This is how, you know, what I'm doing. And actually it's kind of setting up these false expectations, as well as things like kind of photoshopping and so on and so on, where people get these completely unrealistic expectations around the body. And that's actually, to me, more than anything, the food thing, I can kind of just hammer about it. And I've got the authority of kind of being a doctor. The thing that breaks my heart is when you get particularly younger people coming in and they're showing you pictures of Instagram of people and saying, like, is this normal? And so the thing particularly, it's happened slightly less now, but we used to get up until about a year ago, thigh gap, which is this thing, which is actually, in fact, I was having supper with a friend who's an orthopaedic surgeon, and she was saying it's about 1% of people. It's a basic genetic mutation slightly, where your legs slightly bow out, and that's why you have a thigh gap. So it's about 1% of the population. if you look, they're the right kind of weight, and they and their legs have got a particular shape to make them look like they've got a thigh gap. Now, that's basically, all nice, they're basically just genetic freaks, like, lovely. But, you know, but we're all aiming. That's like me looking at Wimbledon and getting upset because I can't play tennis like, you know, Andre Agassi or someone. And it's like, well, yes, but that's because he's just genetically freakish when it comes to hitting a ball with a racket. Like, good luck to him, fantastic. But, you know, if that is gonna, if I'm going to set up my expectations, that's how I'm going to play tennis, I'm going to be really disappointed. And that is how I feel about Instagram, is that it's kind of setting people up who are basically just genetically extraordinary, and that they're setting that up as that is the norm. And then, of course, what you then have is then another whole subset of people that then manipulate those photographs so that it makes it look like they also fall in that category. So then it becomes like, rather than just being 1% really unusual, it then becomes what everybody else looks like this apart from me. And that I find really heartbreaking, because it's very hard then to disprove that for people. Yeah. Because, you know, I can't sort of take off my clothes and go, look, I don't have a thigh gap, deal with it. But that's kind of what you want almost to do. Yeah. You want to like be going, no, this is like, actually, this is not normal. And actually, I remember I was at a dinner party probably about 2 years ago, and I was sitting next to this young woman. She was 16, and actually her dad is someone really well known, and they're really sensible, kind of, you know, upstanding members of society kind of thing. And I was talking about what I was doing, and she was listening to me having this conversation. And just towards the end, I could see her wanting to kind of have a chat, and she sort of tugged me to one side and said, can I just show you something? I just want to see, is this normal? And she just showed me her Instagram. Now, I've not really seen teenagers' Instagram. You know, I know about it. I didn't really know what was going on. And she just flicked through these pictures of just emaciated women. And this was just on her feed. It wasn't like, you know, it was just coming up there. You know, it was just being sort of thrown out in front of her. And my heart went out to her, and I was literally kind of holding her hands going, you've got to realize this is not normal. This is not normal. And we really tried to kind of impress her, thinking there's some, you know, middle-aged fart at a dinner party, like, pleading with her, going, this is not normal. And she's probably sitting there thinking, my God, what a weirdo. But it really, really breaks my heart that these are the kind of expectations we're setting up. So yes, it's partly to do with the kind of fetishization of food and clean eating, but it's also the other things, what we call the orthorexia, and this kind of over-exercising and this kind of unrealistic body image. And to me, that's even more kind of insidious and pervasive.
And are you finding that it's all age ranges who are affected by social media? I suppose people could assume it's maybe the kind of teenagers, but
it's certainly up to, kind of, yes. I mean, we have actually had a few older people that have presented. I mean, one in particular who, her husband had an affair, they got divorced, and she, part of her kind of reinventing herself was like, you know, I'm going to get into technology. And actually then on via sort of Twitter and social media and stuff, I think she tried to get into exercise as a way of kind of meeting people and kind of feeling good about her body, and it just sort of deteriorated. Now, that might have happened anyway. I think it's hard to solely blame social media as the cause, but certainly it's a precipitating factor. And it was interesting with her kind of going, I can't believe I've been so stupid. And I was like, this is not you being stupid. This is happening to loads of people.
We normally come back to a sort of like fun, silly question, but I feel like...
yeah, go on.
I'd be so flippant at this stage. You say such important stuff for me to be like, hey, what's your comfort?
But you know what? I would say that it's that, like, one of the things I love about my job is that I do have to have these really important, serious kind of conversations with people, but I always try to make my patients laugh. We try and have a bit of fun, because I sit there thinking, actually, you know, I think laughter's a great great power for good and in life, and it can be very overwhelming and difficult having all these kind of big conversations. Mm. So actually I always try to have quite a laugh with my patients. Yeah. And one of my patients is actually very depressed a lot of the time. She's very sort of suicidal. She has a very complicated eating disorder. She always says after, so I love coming to see you. And I'm like, thanks. She says, I always have a good laugh with you. That's nice. At least I'm providing a service.
Okay, well then we'll finish so on a fine. High note. And I think I know what you're going to say to this. Can you tell us what your favourite pudding of all time is?
Oh, definitely. So my favourite pudding is, well, it's very specific. So it's baked Alaska, but it's not the Arctic roll kind of baked Alaska. It's not like that. So proper kind of beautiful baked Alaska from the ivy. And it's you have to go with a friend. So I quite literally have got some people, I think, I'm not taking them there because they won't have the baked Alaska. So I'm like, screw you. Because it's for two. And it kind of comes, and it's this like, amazing kind of load of meringue, you know, with the ice cream in the middle. And then they pour over this, I think it's like cherry kirsch with loads and loads of cherries on it. And then they flambé it in front of you. So it's really, really exciting. It's like, it's a sort of like dessert equivalent of like being a celebrity, because everybody then kind of like looks at you and you kind of sit there going, yes. And they kind of very ostentatiously kind of serve it in front of you, and it's still on fire, and it's all very exciting. So definitely 100%. If ever you go to the Ivy, get the baked Alaska. If you're with somebody who doesn't like baked Alaska, ditch them. Find someone else who does like baked Alaska. Take them. It's the best dessert. It's brilliant.
Max, thank you so much for joining Table Talk.
Max's book, The Marvellous Adventures of Being Human, Your Amazing Body and How to Live in It, is out now. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please don't forget to rate, review and subscribe in your podcast provider, as it helps others find the podcast.